I would like to cover the whole scope of the development of various root canal techniques, specifically emphasizing the filling methods. We know the emphasis that you played on the importance of cleaning and shaping canal systems, but still your name and history will always be associated with the obturation, the three-dimensional obturation of root canal systems. And we'd like your perspective on how you feel the whole filling procedure has evolved and where it continues to head.
Okay, I asked you to repeat that question, you know, as we were doing our preparatory remarks here, because I didn't want to lose some current thoughts before getting reflective on earlier developments in endodontics. Right behind you, Roger, two boxes. And of course, this is all private, you say?
Yes.
Okay. One of those boxes is Hydron, and the other one is some other potentially profitable, that's the word, profitable clinical material.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I mention this to you? There's such commercialism in life generally, which as realists we have to accept. But there's so much commercialism in dentistry and in endodontics specifically that I'm beginning to get a really new perspective on how this influences endodontics. We can talk about Hydron later, but let's quickly talk about the other box sitting on top of it. This new material that some commercial outfits would like to push is nothing more than sulfuric acid in an old Callahan-Johnson cleaning technique description with a filling material that contains Bakelite that the dealer who got his hands on thought is new because it says it's new. It comes from a Dutch manufacturer by way of ancient materials in the southeastern part of the United States. Now the materials are referring to techniques that are 50 years old. But it gets revivified now because of this ferment about different kinds of filling techniques. And its success or failure may depend not upon its biologic adaptability or usefulness, but it can depend upon the hype that goes with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had to point out to the people that it contains 10% sulfuric acid, and I didn't think they should deal with it simply on the basis of potentiality for suit and danger to the patients. But I had a feeling that if it didn't actually have the 10% sulfuric acid, which I knew the old Callahan irrigating materials contained, if they could sell it, they'd sell it. And if they could put it into an attractive enough promotional campaign, it would become popular for a while. We'll come back to Hydron later too. But this is Tuesday night at the Colonnade Hotel lobby, you know. There was a table clinic by the manufacturer on Hydron. I've heard numbers on the sales of potential Hydron from anywhere from $1 million to $50 million. So that's a little crazy, those numbers, but that's what I hear. And here we have a totally unproven product, which I guess we ought to come to later, which is being hyped by a private company, a patent company, who never had a dental branch but see money, and they're pushing this thing. Where presently, I think it's probably as famous or infamous as N2. I'd say that at the present time, the hype for Hydron equals the hype for N2. And where, you know, Mel, if keeping this open, is the one who's been pushing this, where he would criticize Sargenti for giving clinics and hotel lobbies, this is the same thing, except Mel's not there. The people who he sells the rights to are there in hotel lobbies, not just in the Colonnade. Campaign for the entire United States. Have you had any phone calls in the office?
Oh, sure.
It's a boiler shop operation in New York City, in New York, Long Island, and they get you on the phone. It's a boiler shop operation where they're just pushing the stuff wildly, and before it goes back and fades away, it'll have a vogue with no particular merit other than N2. But that's just as a preliminary about what goes on in filling techniques. Now, if you want to speak about the subject from a historic perspective as I see it, I indicated to you last time that before there was formalized endodontic training, there were isolated people who intuitively seemed to know what to do. This particular area had a fellow named Barney Berg Filled root canals tremendously. Sectional filling, by the way, but cold, very difficult to perform. Other people had the concept. Elmer Jasper, the fellow with silver cones, did nice gutta percha work in earlier days. He could pack a canal well. Other people as well. So intuitively, people seem to have the idea that if you fill it well, you're going to be all right. People like Otto Lingui, you can look him up in Dental Items of Interest in the old journals. Great dentist with interest in endodontics. Knew that you had to get the crap out of the root canals and you had to stuff them. And they knew this simply by the results. If you stuffed them, they succeeded. If you didn't stuff them, they didn't. Billy Walker's dad, who's got to be 80-some-odd years old in Chicago, had a little poem, I don't remember. Better two than something, but better through than two, with the filling material. And with no education in endodontics at all, he knew it was better through the apex than it was to the apex. And yet this is seemingly against the biology of the system. And esoteric people would argue it. And people who would have flare-ups for different reasons other than this would blame their flare-ups on the excess. And oral surgeons would claim you had to cut it out. But still, to stuff the root canal system seemed to work. And not to stuff it seemed not to work. Well, the history of endodontics was to fill first with pastes. And the pastes were commonly used, iodoform kinds of pastes, medicinal pastes. And there was a whole group of people in Central Europe who were filling with pastes, things that would give off chemicals later. And in a historic perspective, Sargenti is right in line with them. Sargenti is not off historic perspective. He's in it. He's behind the times. But Sargenti is not a new phenomenon. Sargenti is almost in direct line with the pharmacologists of Prinz and the pharmacology even of Grossman. It's almost the same kind of thing, amazingly similar. So pastes were the popular filling materials. And as I say, there are a whole variety from zinc oxide up. Mike Ewell, when he was here giving a seminar 2 years ago, claims that when he was in dental school 20-some-odd years ago, I can't believe it, at his school, one of the schools in Chicago, all endodontics was to put in a brooch, pull out the pulp, and shove in a paste, which it is in many parts of Europe today, in some of the low countries, in Holland, in Amsterdam. I've seen dental clinics where every dental chair had its molten metal sterilizer and root canal therapy 10 years ago, 9 years ago. Pull out the pulp and shove in a paste with a certain degree of success. So when you think of Sargenti, it's just he has a paste that he thinks is a better paste. Other people had their paste. In this perspective, you can almost think of chloropercha as a different kind of paste. By my saying chloropercha, we begin to feel closer to what we believe in. Because if we say paste of iodoform, you go poo-poo. Yet it worked for a lot of guys. Wyckoff's paste, these things were working for a lot of people. Giese paste with arsenic, these were popular. And it worked for a lot of people. We might add in here, if the other fellows didn't tell you, many of these pastes contained arsenic. As a matter of fact, on the front seat of the car, some chemicals from Europe, which I've been asked to evaluate, including from France, arsenic paste still being used. So let's make that skip from these medicinal pastes, even with arsenic, into a loose mixture of chloropercha, which became popular when people began to be a little less inclined to use the other pastes for one reason or the other.
So you're placing paste historically as the beginning, the whole Roman numeral one of root canal filling materials.
Right. What I am doing is eliminating Lou's academic list of somebody using feathers and somebody using a piece of wood stuffed with creosote, the oddball kinds of things that occurred. Because, yeah, they used to whittle a piece of wood like a toothpick and wet it with creosote and hammer it in. But that's oddball. When you speak about that, you're not speaking about large numbers of people. Also, you have to think of the European concept where they didn't have radiographs, couldn't see where they were going anyway. And it made sense to put in the brooch, pull out the pulp, and shove in the paste because you didn't have a film to see where you were going in any event. You didn't know where you were going. So yeah, I'd say that in terms of dealing in terms of hundreds or a thousand dentists, pastes would be it. Not in any way questioning, you know, what Lou can pull out of somebody doing something strange. And gutta percha became popular. It's been around over 100 years now, as you well know. It's about 110 years in dentistry. And gutta percha became popular as one of the pastes as time went along, and it was used as a paste with the solvent technique, basically chloropercha, and sometimes eucapercha, oil of eucalyptus. Now, we mentioned Callahan before. Callahan and Johnson developed their technique, which, you know, boiled down for this kind of purpose, not to give a lecture on it, included using the sulfuric acid and then flooding the root canals with chloroform. And with the root canals flooded with chloroform, first you blew into them to dry them out, and you used alcohol to dry them and dehydrate them. And then you put chloroform in, and then you put in a loosely fitting gutta percha cone, and you pressed against that, and you made soup. Got a lot of accessory canals with it. Then they, a lot of people objected to that, irritation from the chloroform, and they began to use chloropercha much more effectively by making a little paste of chloropercha in a Dappen dish and putting a little in the canal, and using gutta percha cones now, just dipped into the paste, or not even in it, just use what's in the canal. So you reduce the amount of paste enormously. You got down to things with lateral condensation. That's where lateral condensation got popular. Lateral condensation with a a minimal amount of chloroform in a chloropercha technique. Then you got down to Nygaard Ospe, who began to involve resin in these things, chloresin, and try to get it thicker and use less chloropercha. And you began to then get into either ego trips or commercial trips. If you read in the hygienic catalog, which I was looking at this week, on their gutta percha, they still saw gutta percha N.O., Nygaard Ospe. He was friendly with Mr. Keith and the company. And he had his gutta percha rolled a special way, and it got to be special. Longland just left. We were talking about some Scandinavian who's trying to introduce a new kind of gutta percha, which is not new, but he used in his little shtetl, his little paisa, his little countryside someplace in Scandinavia. He wants to know why people don't use this kind of gutta percha. But basically, I think we had a big, big time of using chloropercha from the Callahan and Johnson soup to rather good controlled lateral condensation techniques with minimal amounts of chloropercha. But the step now comes from the uncontrollability of the chloropercha. Because as you've heard me say a thousand times, if you're dealing in any kind of conical shape and you press laterally, you get a vertical component of force. If you press vertically, you get a lateral component of force. And they were running the chloropercha through the end of the roots with the lateral condensation. It was going to do. The case has succeeded. But you had the large body who were afraid of the excess and attributing the failures to the excess. And there was pain with the chloroform, albeit you get over it. And if you weren't afraid of that, the healing was enormous with it. At that time, there were a series of articles published even within my time, maybe when you were in dental school, not in endodontics, where people would publish old chloropercha cases and say, in amazement, they say, gee whiz, it succeeded. And look at the excess. Because they had the success and they couldn't believe it. They literally had the success and couldn't believe that they were getting that that success. From that, they began to introduce other techniques, using the gutta percha with non-solvent cements. And they began to use cements that were either used by some people alone or by some people with the silver cones, which were emerging at this time, non-solvent cements, like Carseela. And the Carseela is the old Reichert's formula. That's a very important thing in endodontics, I think, in North America, in that with minimal modifications that precipitated silver, zinc oxide, resin formula with various liquids, basically eugenol, with minimal modifications, became Grossman cement, became Procosol cement, is the cursed sealer in its unmodified form. Reichert hit upon something that's been used by many, many people with the idea of having less contractibility with the rosin and stickiness and workability and radio opacity and antibacterial activity, and you began to get that. But many, many followed it, and some of them vastly different. Diakit, KH26, but a variety of non-solvent cements then became popular, and people try to adapt the same lateral condensation techniques to the non-solvent cements that they had applied previously with the solvent cements. And that became really a bastardization, but they didn't understand it. They didn't know that. When they were using the non-solvent cements, as you've heard me say before, and I've written, they began to freeze gutta-percha in a sea of cement. There's no way you do this in the glass. There's no way that you can press that gutta-percha so the gutta-percha blends in lateral condensation. You knock the teeth from the right-hand side of the jaw to the left-hand side of the jaw without succeeding. So what they were getting were radial opaque fillings and seemingly dense fillings, but actually it was gutta-percha frozen in that sea of cement. And the dentist alive and dentist dead will never believe that when they use their lateral condensation technique, if you opened up that tooth, you had nothing but the three gutta-percha cones, still as much as they were, and a lot of cement around them. To the extent that the canal was sealed anyway, they got away with it. But they weren't really blending their gutta-percha. And with all this, silver cones developed, basically in Europe, and then popularized in America by Jasper in St. Louis. And he came along with the silver cones, which a lot of people picked up. Now, the main popularity for the silver cones, as you can guess, were the radial opacity and the ease with which you can thread them into a canal. They became popular for two reasons. They became popular because you could take them to the end of the canal. You pre-fit them. And the other thing, there had been a lot of abuse with the solvent techniques. So they seemed to answer a need. A lot of abuse with the solvent techniques, sloppy stuff with the solvent techniques, which people got careless with.
So for the really, I get the impression that at the time that silver cones came into vogue, there was a feeling, at least amongst really conscientious endodontists or people doing a lot of endodontics, for a more technical type thing, more of a cookbook approach, but with more exacting detail, more respect to millimeter lengths and things like that.
Exactly. Exactly. Take some of the anything goes. Take the shove in the paste, the pull out the pulp and shove in the paste kind of idea to become more precise. In point of fact, they didn't become any more precise as a group because of the cleaning and shaping techniques not having been developed as yet. Basically, they were dealing, as you've heard me say so many times, with verticality, and they were worried about half a millimeter from the apex or there or whatever, and it was a big verticality concept, and they were ripping the ends out of their canals and coming into a whole variety of other kinds of problems. But that was the idea, sure, to begin to bring some precision to this. Of course, with the number two silver cone, you have to laugh what it could fill anyway, but that was the trend. Myself, I started on chloropercha at New York University. I became persuaded with silver cones when I took graduate training in Philadelphia. I came to Boston as a silver cone man. I used silver cones in anterior teeth. Split silver cones, finally. But I use silver cones in anterior teeth. If you fill them solidly with anything, they're going to succeed. The big problem that was happening, though continuously, was the poor failure rate. And other people had begun to talk, and I became convinced that the major cause of failure was the failure to seal. And that what people were doing, whatever their technique, was to have a hang-up on verticality. And not to be concerned with three-dimensionality. Mm-hmm. And translated quickly down to things you know, if it leaks then through a main canal and you haven't got three-dimensionality, the whole damn thing is leaking. If it's not stoppered, then the whole thing is leaking. And therefore I believed in filling the whole root canal system three-dimensionally, so any potential leak through any little foramina can't amount to a hell of a lot, because the main body is already cleaned and shaped and is sealed up.
Yeah, just to digress for one second, the verticality problem in endodontics, the hang-up of verticality, do you envision that as finally becoming passé?
Well, depends on what level you know I answer that question. Between endodontists now, you see. I could in one breath tell you, yes, amongst knowledgeable people, that's done. I've been on the phone this week and spoken to Nadoff, who was here in Longland, and spoke to endodontists in Texas, and had all kinds of compliments about my contributions to endodontics and how all this stuff is done. I can tell you that fine. I can also tell you that one of our BU graduates was in a lawsuit in Washington, D.C., outside of Washington, in Rockland County, $10.5 million. $3.5 million treble damages. and it had to do with overfilling. And we won the case. There wasn't a nickel paid. But the last thing the patient's attorney pulled out was the April copy of the Maryland State Dental Journal, in which the general dentist, sorry, general dentist in Arundel County were asked for that filling technique, and only 0.8% agreed that it was okay to go beyond the ends of the apex. Now, I made it clear to the judge, and he understood that we weren't trying the ignorance of the general dentist in Arundel County. We were always on trial with the competence of the endodontist, and that the material introduced was irrelevant. You get the point, it was the ignorance mm-hmm. of the dentist. But with that kind of information, I'm a little more humble in my response to you. You know, when you ask your question, the question has to be understood in different levels. So if you take the general dentist in Arundel County, influenced by their previous education, only 1%, slightly less than 1%, comprehend this. And hell, they're legitimate dentists.
So in terms of forensic dentistry or in defensive dentistry, with the advent of consumerism in the last 15 years, there still is a potential problem.
There's a potential problem. You know me well enough to feel that any such case can be defended. And completely, I showed that jury everything from slides to histology in human beings, with over which we have now, by the way, mm-hmm. block sections in human beings. All the patients' names are being transformed into foreign names. So this work will either be done in the jungles of Colombia or the hills of Afghanistan. But we have human blocks showing the new bone healing right against these materials. In any event, I think amongst knowledgeable people, you know, to begin to seriously answer your question, having thought it through, I think amongst knowledgeable people, even people who want to fill short, I can't find anybody who would seriously argue, you know, filling through, if that's what happens. But amongst those less knowledgeable, I don't know. There's a fellow taking the course this week from Northwestern. Smulson called yesterday to say, look after him. He may be the department chairman someday. He was trained in a program that had an endodontic professor, not at Northwestern, who wasn't clinically oriented. This kid doesn't believe in doing that. He doesn't know. That may be a step backward, the full-time teacher who doesn't practice, who doesn't know. But in the environment that I find myself in, it's very, very easily accepted and understood. And I would like to feel then that everything is in motion to say that we're on the threshold, at least, of a better understanding of this. Siskin used to call some of my cases, they said they had celestial garbage. He can't do that anymore because, you know, everything is with me. The trend the audience was speaking to, if they're endodontists, they understand. If they're not, I can persuade them within a half hour. You know, he can tell them what he wants, I can show them what I show and see these things. The clinical reality is that it heals consistently, 100%. They can't believe that. If the system is sealed. And the excess is irrelevant. That's the word I use now, Roger. The excess is neither therapeutic or counter-therapeutic. The root canal system must be filled in three dimensions. What happens beyond that is irrelevant. If the patient's having pain or difficulty, it wasn't because of that excess material. It was an excess. The root canal system wasn't sealed. So to put this in perspective, I think we got to lay on this. My line that I use in the dental clinics for North America over 10 years ago, to make the distinction between vertical overextension of an underfilled case
and overfilling,
which is filling in three dimensions and then filling in excess. Well, I was very impressed when I was a student, or soon after that, with the paper that Dow did, Pierre Dow, with Engel, where they did a radioactive iodine study.
Was it 1955,
52? 52-ish to 55, sure. I used to have everybody read this. And a little study, wasn't much of a study, but it made a big impression on me that so many failures had to do with the underfilled root canals. They were dealing with simple teeth. And if it was true in simple teeth, I felt, gee, it had to be applicable to more complicated teeth. Of course, they never did anything about that except to bemoan the fact. And I began then, way back then, to say what we really need. And I coined that phrase, which was simple enough, it's simple English, to describe what I wanted, a three-dimensional root canal filling, to teach the people that if you're dealing with the lower anterior tooth, you got three or four times more labiolingual than you have mesiodistally, and damn it, it is there. You know, right when we do the warm gutta percha courses now, and we blow up all those slides that these guys make, The last three courses, there wasn't one lower anterior tooth that didn't have two canals, or at least with a common apex. But as I blow it up and show it to them, even people have just done a case here and didn't know it. When we show it to them blown up, you can see the two canals filled and superimposed over each other. So it got to be the three-dimensional kind of effect. The thing that moved me, I think, massively was when I was using split silver cones and I began packing warm gutta percha in the middle third of the canal on top of the split silver cone apically, that even with the silver cone so tight that all that hydrostatic pressure couldn't move them, I could push curlicues of cement in this process past the silver cone, which made me say that even the silver cones weren't tight. So in my own development, I then came to the point of always wanting a puff. And I became known for this with Sam Seltzer and the shoulder puff.
That's the magic dragon.
That's right. I wanted the puff with all the silver cones, because I didn't give a damn if you can hang yourself on that silver cone. And my silver cones, you could hang yourself on without getting them out. By virtue of the fact that I could press warm gutta percha just in a mass with some curved sealant in the middle third after splitting off the top, where there hadn't been an excess before the the silver was cemented, pressing against there, you could run a little curlicue past and the film would appear later. So I knew damn well these things were not sealed. Then we did all kinds of isotope studies and dye studies and demonstrated that you couldn't seal them perfectly without. So that was the idea of the three-dimensionality. From that I became interested in it clinically and I began to develop some of the slides that you've seen, and now it is enormously developed into the problems that occur and showing failures, of which the Ingle-Dow study was a stimulus to me. Did you ever see those teeth that John West did?
Yes.
Incredible things. But we've done this from so many different directions now on getting to know the root canal system, which was there before I called it the root canal system, but nobody wanted to. You get this interesting historic perspective. The Europeans knew there was a system, without saying those words. They knew they called them ramifications, and went after them chemically to do something with the bugs in those ramifications. The American dentists and endodontists chose to ignore it. Callahan Johnson was picking them up. But the mainstream, hey, let's take mainstream, Lou, Ralph Soma, Darrell Ostrand. Now we're talking about the mainstream with the knowledge, or what they should have had the knowledge. They just arbitrarily, categorically, totally, and comfortably, for them, not for the patients, chose to ignore it. What a guy like Sargenti knew. What somebody like Bernard, who shoves slaked lime into teeth in France, knows. The ramifications to get in there. They were fumigating what was in those little canals. And the mainstream of American endodontics chose to ignore it. And it's no accident that they talk about the 20% failure rate. This guy from Northwestern here is telling some of our graduate students, no system works more than 80%. It's bullshit. If you cut your face shaving, do you heal? 80% of the time. Does your heart, skip beats all the, only 80% of the time it's rhythmic? Do you miss a breath every four breaths? But we came up in endodontics and we defended them as biologically sensible. You sit in meetings and they say, biologically sensible, who ever heard of anything working more than 80%? And the defense was the inability to seal his root canals. Those failures the good men were getting were the bifid apex that weren't filled, the second canal that wasn't taken care of, the mesiobuccal canal of the upper first molar where only one canal was filled, and where there may have been a second canal. And these were the failures. But we just blindly, intelligent people blindly chose to ignore it. Hence my entry into that, get after the root canal systems. I wish no teeth had accessory canals. Who the hell needs them? But they are there. They're there. They're there constantly. So that got into my modification then, which I view to be the height of simplicity. And anybody who wants to change it now, they're making a variation on a theme, in my judgment. It's a variation on a theme. My thing is, if you're going to use gutta percha, which I firmly believe has the track record in endodontics for so many biologic and mechanical reasons, if you want to seal the root canal system in a vertical structure, basically, it's crazy to push to the side. You want to push up to the end. And if you want to get the material soft, and you don't want to soften with a chemical, you can soften it with heat. So you warm it, you press it in. I've told 1,000 people, tens of thousands, if I didn't come along with it, I tell them, you'd invent it yourself. If somebody sat you in a room all by yourself and never taught you anything else about endodontics, and said, here's a shaped canal, how are you going to fill it? You'd invent it to take the material and to place it in. And of course the Hydron and the other stuff are now different ways to try to get plasticized material to squirt into a system. But it's basically getting what the Committee on Standards of the AEE, which Mel Goldman is trying to break, the standard of having a solid, non-resorbable material, which will three-dimensionally and permanently seal Edward Cannell system, and a minimal amount of sealing material, to attach it to the wall, whereas and as is necessary, which, by the way, our studies now, I can show you cement linings that are down to angstrom units, mm-hmm. in angstrom units, to seal it off. And how you get it in there is any way you want, but pushing it up vertically in a slightly softened way makes a lot of sense to a lot of people. But that is the concept of our feeling. And of course the reward was the results. Then we had to defend the results we were getting, because nobody would believe the 100% results. That grudge changed the whole concept about periapical lesions. You see, it's a step-by-step kind of phenomenon. First we had to get the things clean, then we had to get them filled. Once we got them filled, that's when we began to change the whole concept on lesions of endodontic origin. Because until you were getting the system sealed, to get your success rate near the 100, which is biologically what it is capable of, limited by what you're doing inside the root canal, the tissue is 100% capable of healing. When we began to get the results, that came up with a new step forward controversy, however you want to call it. Controversy, step forward, a step forward controversy, which is a non-controversy. Everybody's getting to this point now. Maybe not in Arundel County, but everybody's getting used to the idea. You know, the trend is in that all lesions of endodontic origin heal, even though IB and SAM still can't bear it. But the fact is that these things are healing because the root canal system is healed. And you see, it's a step-by-step thing. That changes the biology. Now we get pathologists who are saying that epitheliated granulomas heal. Not because some schnook endodontist wants to say that a cyst heals because he's got some special interest in it. But now that we see them heal, we're getting a change in the understanding of lesions of endodontic origin, which becomes a biologic imperative that comes from this. So the whole thing changes on the basis of dealing with the root canal system.
Okay, with again, the